Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Anthony Lewis, whose latest book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, A Biography of the First Amendment. Anthony Lewis is author of Gideon's Trumpet, Portrait of a Decade, and Make No Law, The Sullivan Case and the First Amendment. Columnist for the New York Times, 1969 to 2001, lectures in law at Harvard and Columbia. Anthony Lewis, this particular book, Freedom for the Thought We Hate, A Biography of the First Amendment, what prompted you to come out with it at this particular time?
Well, I'm not a natural instant book writer. Some journalists can write books once a year. I don't do that. I seem to gestate them. And I have taught this subject at various places since 1973. That's a pretty long time. And I've thought about it all my life. And it just seemed like a way to express feelings that were in me, which are concentrated by the, what shall I say, I think the word is lawlessness of the Bush administration.
Before we get into some of the specifics of the book, a couple of quick questions regarding the Bush administration, because you've written several articles. You wrote an article on torture not that long ago and the Bush administration's view toward torture. And at the time, in the article, you said that American people don't seem to care too much. Do you think that's changed in the past couple of years?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't think so. I think it remains sort of on the fringe of the national consciousness, and I regard it as something profoundly important that my country should be engaging in, should have engaged, whether it still is, I don't know, but should have engaged deliberately as a policy in the torture of prisoners is appalling to me.
When the Democrats took over in 2006, early 2007, Nancy Pelosi said impeachment was off the table. And it remains off the table. What's your view on that?
My view is that if Nancy Pelosi thinks it's off the table, it's probably not very fruitful to discuss it because it's not going to get anywhere. But I think there are grounds for impeachment, certainly compared to the most recent impeachment we had, the sort of joke about Bill Clinton's sex life. It's pretty serious. We've had a president who tortures people, detains American citizens without trial, without counsel, and lied us into a war in Iraq. I'd say it was pretty serious, but if you ask me, is it going to happen? No, it's not.
There are two schools of thought. One is, well, they could never get impeachment through. The assumption is that not even House Democrats would vote for impeachment. And on the other hand, it doesn't really matter once the hearings get started because the door opens and we begin to see the light. And I'm just curious what your impression of those two arguments is.
Well, they kind of come together for me because it's hard to get a real passion going for an impeachment that you know is not going to happen. I was present, literally present, at the one that the impeachment process that had the exact effect you talked about, your second alternative, and that was the Nixon one, where the House Judiciary Committee conducted very powerful hearings and took very important votes in which Southern Democrats and a few Republicans joined in finding several articles of impeachment against Nixon, and he eventually resigned. So that's what you need. But you can't do it with a very divided House and with Republicans who simply will not entertain any ill thoughts about Bush. Still, they may be cringing at the thought of having to defend his record, but they still defend him in public.
Anthony Lewis, let's talk about Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. This history of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. The First Amendment was adopted in 1791, and then 7 years later, we had the Alien and Sedition Act, which seemed to be a contradiction of the First Amendment. In your book, you kind of say, not really, because the First Amendment was more or less ill-defined, and nobody really examined the issue of seditious libel. So let's talk first about seditious libel, and then about the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Well, I have to say right off that your view of it, that the Sedition Act was in conflict with the 7-year-old First Amendment, was exactly the view that James Madison had. He was the author of the First Amendment, so you're on sound ground, I would say. The thing is, that's important to understand, in those days, people did not, as we do, think of running to a court when something is unconstitutional. Their response was political. Madison and Jefferson started a movement to repeal the Sedition Act. They didn't go to court. And that's perhaps why we think of it as not having, you know, it never got to the Supreme Court, and it wasn't adjudged at that time.
Then let's talk a little about what is seditious libel and how does that play into this?
I'll take it back to its English origins. Seditious libel in the 17th and 18th centuries was critical comment on the king or queen, the church, the government. And it didn't matter whether it was true or false. The essence of the crime lay in lowering public regard for the great institution that you criticized. And if it was true, you might lower it, the regard even more. It wasn't a casual thing to be charged with seditious libel because the maximum punishment was execution in a particularly horrible way. So it was a very intimidating offense that tended to create self-censorship, of course. You didn't want to be charged with seditious libel.
And this is pretty much the rationale used for the Alien Sedition Act.
Well, the sponsors, who were the Federalist Party, then controlling both houses of Congress and the presidency, John Adams, claimed that it was needed to stop French Jacobin terrorists from creeping into the United States. Well, that has a familiar ring to it. But actually, it was designed to keep the supporters of Thomas Jefferson quiet in the run-up to the election of 1800, a couple of centuries in advance there, in the election of 1800, in which Jefferson, the vice president, would stand against Adams, the president. And it worked. They used it against the 14 editors. They were fined, imprisoned, and it was quite intimidating.
200 years later, because we have people like Scalia or Thomas, and perhaps to some degree Alito, according to Jeffrey Toob and Roberts is a different case, who look at the Constitution in terms of the original meaning. Now, you say in Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, Anthony Lewis, you say that, in fact, if you look at what people really thought about the First Amendment when they were writing it, you can't really get too much of a hint at what the deeper meaning was. However, from what you're saying now, it appears that these folks could just as easily say, well, the original meaning excluded seditious libel.
You mean as Madison said?
Yeah.
I think Justice Scalia would say that. Justice Scalia has not found his views about original intent in conflict with vigorous enforcement of the freedom of speech and press. For example, he cast the deciding vote, the fifth vote, in favor of the person who burned the flag. That was a fairly far-out application of the freedom of speech clause, and Scalia was with the majority. So he takes a different view. There wasn't any firm... Nobody sat down in 1791 and said, this is what I mean by the First Amendment. They just made general statements about how important free speech was.
Well, what about the other amendments? I spoke with Gary Wills a couple of years ago, and his point about the originalists was that a lot of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, they were compromises. He said, look, you know, slavery existed then. How could you talk about the original intent when what you're talking about the compromises, or Jeffrey Toobin, when I talked to him, he said a lot of it was written on the fly. And yet these people look at this original intent as if it was written in stone.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. The thing is that not only the point that you made, or that Jeffrey made, that these clauses were often written on the fly or compromised on the floor of one house or another, but they were written in very broad language. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. It wasn't a laundry list. What we mean by that is you can't throw people in jail for burning the flag. You can't stop people who stand on a soapbox and make speeches. You can't close the New York Times when it publishes the Pentagon Papers. It wasn't like that. They deliberately wrote it in language that would have to be interpreted in the context of whenever it happened. The bottom line here is that it's up to the courts to say what it means from time to time. That's our system. And it's a very strange system in some ways, but I want to tell you that since World War II, it's been copied by many countries that never had a constitutional system before of enforcement by judges, and they've decided that's the right answer, and that's our answer.
But in fact, the judges didn't even begin to make those kinds of decisions until, and that was 1919.
It's extraordinary, really. People today think that, well, the First Amendment is there. It was written in 1791, so we've always been protected by this wonderful amendment. Not true. Added to the Constitution in 1791, first actually enforced by the Supreme Court to protect a speaker or publisher in 1931, 140 years later. The 1919 case you mentioned was the first opinion strongly speaking up for freedom of speech, but that was a dissenting opinion by Justice Holmes.
And it wasn't until the 14th Amendment that anyone even considered that freedom of speech applied to the states.
That's right. States had their own constitutions, and many of them did purport at least, to protect freedom of speech and of the press. But it wasn't until 1925 that the Supreme Court said the First Amendment's clauses about speech and press were made applicable to the states by the post-Civil War Amendment, the 14th Amendment.
Anthony Lewis, you actually wrote a book, Make No Law, about the Sullivan case. What was the Sullivan case, and what was its importance in terms of the First Amendment?
1964. And it all arose from Dr. King's efforts to arouse the South, arouse the country, I should say, against segregation and discrimination in the South. The New York Times published an ad put in by supporters of Dr. King, which deplored the brutalization of civil rights leaders in the South and said that Southern officials, white racist officials, had abused them, imprisoned them, beaten them. It didn't mention any names of these Southern officials. It called them Southern violators of the Constitution. But one of them, Mr. Sullivan, a commissioner of the city of Montgomery, Alabama, sued, saying that people might think the New York Times was talking about him, and that would lower his reputation. In fact, Justice Black, who came from Alabama, said in the concurring opinion in the case that if the white people of Montgomery, for some reason, saw the New York Times, and not many did, and connected the ad with Commissioner Sullivan, they probably would have thought better of him, not worse. But anyway, he won $500,000 in damages from an all-white jury, libel damages, the highest amount ever awarded in a libel case in Alabama to that point. And the case went on up to the Supreme Court. Now, until then, this is hard to understand, libel had always been considered outside the protection of the First Amendment. So it took really something quite drastic for the Supreme Court to say, no, this is going too far. And that's what the Supreme Court did. And it went back to what we discussed a few minutes ago, the Sedition Act of 1798. Justice Brennan said for the court, the act, the Sedition Act, was never tested in this court, but it has been found wanting in the court of history. And with that, he, in effect, held unconstitutional a statute that had expired 164 years earlier.
So we're talking about something only 40 years ago.
Oh, yes. And it was a very broad interpretation of the clauses for freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
A couple of other cases, one of which you don't really go into in your book. I'm just curious about it. On July 1st, 1934, the production code was enforced in Hollywood, and that was in reaction to noises from Congress that they were going to enact laws limiting
sex.
Limiting sex, more than that.
In the movies.
In the movies, yeah. Well, it was more than sex. It was also sex politics. I mean, a lot of it might have had to do with fears that the studio system could be broken up. Of course, these were very wealthy men. A lot of it could have had to do with fear from looking over at Europe and knowing that, in fact, the Jewish heads of the studios could find themselves in trouble in the U.S. as well. But I'm just curious, had the code not been enforced, where could things have gone, do you think? Here it was on that particular day, Hollywood changed.
Yes, for the worse. It stifled creativity in Hollywood for a long time. But I have to tell you that the basic thing that I think governed the legal reaction to it, and the reason I didn't treat it in the book, is that the First Amendment only applies to actions by government. The original text is Congress shall make no law, and then by interpretation, the states shall make no law. But that doesn't affect private individuals. The studios or Hollywood collectively could put in a code and enforce it in the sense of denying funds to make movies and so on. But it wasn't the government doing it. It was the threat of government, and that wasn't enough to invoke the First Amendment.
Then over the years, we know that that's one particular case. How often do you think that threat came up to stifle speech until 1964?
Often, and it hasn't stopped since. Self-censorship is one of the most dire problems in the area of speech and press. There's fear. Let's take a current example. After 9/11, the newspapers failed to perform their function, what Madison thought was their most profound function, of keeping the government honest, holding it accountable, that is, probing for what the government was really doing. We were led into the Iraq War with almost no attention from the main press in the United States. And after a year or two later, the New York Times and the Washington Post actually published apologies for their indolence and their failure to do their job. So that was self-censorship, and that happens all the time.
Do you think it's still happening in terms of Bush and the Republicans?
I don't think so. Not in the mainstream of what you could call the establishment press. The New York Times has been very aggressive in lately, since the period I just spoke of, in finding out what Bush is doing about secret prisons abroad and torture. It actually was the Washington Post that published the story about secret prisons abroad. The New York Times published about torture and also did the famous story about warrantless illegal wiretapping. So, no, I say they're doing their job now. It's the job that Madison thought was the most important, keeping the government honest.
You're listening to an interview with Anthony Lewis, whose latest book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Anthony Lewis, since you've been covering political issues and legal issues since the early 60s, a long, long time, I'd like to ask you about some specific issues that have come up, one of which is laws concerning celebrity stalking. I know that you talk and hear about how if someone is famous, even if they were born famous, people can pretty much stalk them at will, which is a problem on the one hand. And on the other hand, you know, shouldn't anybody get a little bit of privacy?
Well, I think so. And there is a degree of privacy. The famous case of Jacqueline Onassis. She was stalked by a photographer who's Ron Galella, I think I've remembered his name, who used to jump out from behind a bush in Central Park when she was walking with her children and frighten her and the children and take pictures. And eventually she went to court and she won a decree that required Galella to stay a certain number of feet away from her at all times, 30 feet, 40 feet, I forget. So there is a degree, but not much. The Supreme Court has been not much interested in the issue of privacy. I happen personally to think it's very, very important. I think people are entitled to a degree of privacy, although I have to add that today's young people don't seem very interested in it. They let it all hang out on the web. But I like privacy.
There's also the web itself. A rumor spreads on the web, and it doesn't stop, even after it's refuted.
Absolutely doesn't stop, like the one about Obama.
Right.
Barack Obama saying, you know, this web, instead that he's a Muslim and he's done this and that, all lies. But how do you stop it? It's, you know, it's like a mushroom growing underground.
Another issue concerns child porn. Not too long ago, a radio host out here who claims he was simply doing research to talk about child porn got caught in a sting about child porn.
I think the political reality is that child pornography is off limits. And you'd be very ill-advised to do research on the subject because even if it's genuine research, I mean, you really want to write about it or broadcast about it. Some busybody will find you and expose you or get a district attorney who needs publicity to prosecute you. You know, it's a subject so fraught with fear and loathing by the public that you just shouldn't do it. It's not as if this were the first time that something has been effectively just put aside from the First Amendment's protection. Periodically in the United States, we've been swept by fears in times of stress or war, the Sedition Act of 1798 being the first. We had McCarthyism. We had the post-World War I radicalism scare. We had, Japanese Americans being moved out of California in World War II and the whole West Coast. So it's not unusual that this country is swept by fears. Fears which are enforced at law. The Supreme Court refused to intervene in the Japanese relocation program, not its happiest day.
And I'm sure we could look beyond, we could look even in areas. Maybe if the communist fears of the 50s were happening today, we'd find people getting busted for trying to read literature online.
That's possible, although it's much harder to enforce. But certainly the 50s were a very grim time for civil liberties if you had any colorable taint of communist association. A lecturer at Vassar was sent to prison, and the Supreme Court upheld the conviction by a vote of 5-4 because he wouldn't talk about his associations. The Communist Party leaders, by then utterly bereft of any conceivable influence or threat, were sent to prison, and the Supreme Court upheld those convictions. It wasn't a happy time. You're quite right.
How scared should we be of right-wing demagogues these days?
Well, you've asked a tough question for somebody who believes in free speech. And I'm sure you meant
to. There you
go. Sure you meant to. But let me put it this way. When the Supreme Court was listening to the argument in the case of New York Times against Sullivan that we discussed earlier, I was there listening to it, and the person who argued for the New York Times was seeking absolute freedom to say critical things about public officials, true or false. And that was Professor Herbert Wexler of Columbia, a wonderful lawyer. One of the justices, I think it was Justice Goldberg, asked him, Professor Wexler, are you saying that a newspaper could publish a story saying that the mayor had taken a bribe of $10,000 a false story and published it knowing it was false, and the mayor couldn't sue for libel? And Wexler, without a pause, said, if I take my cue from James Madison, my answer is yes, that's what I'm saying. And if you believe in free speech, you have to allow free speech for people who really get you angry. Freedom for the thought that we hate.
And what about obscenities? Okay, there are the seven dirty words. Now we've got a situation where the FCC is fining broadcasters hundreds of thousands of dollars for...
showing Janet Jackson's, what was it called, clothing episode or something like that?
Wardrobe malfunction.
Yes, that's it. Yes, very good.
Wardrobe malfunction. But they also, not too long ago, fined the program NYPD Blue for something that happened like 3 years ago that nobody cares about. There seems to be some kind of disconnect at this point between the FCC and the rest of this country.
I couldn't agree more. I think the FCC, perhaps because of its membership appointed by President Bush, thinks its role in life is to be a nanny in a country that doesn't want a nanny anymore. Also, it's been overtaken by technology. We used to censor movies, and the Supreme Court justices actually sat there in a darkened room and played these movies to decide whether they could be censored, a really hilarious scene. But it's been overtaken by the web. Anybody can tune into anything they want on the web, so that really doesn't have any meaning. What is the FCC doing? It's preposterous.
There's a man in Berkeley by the name of John Yoo who has a very strange interpretation of the Constitution. What's your opinion of people like Yoo? I mean, do you think he's sincere, or do you think he's just justifying whatever his political allies want him to justify?
Well, you know, actually, it's interesting. I'm here in Berkeley, and the fact that Professor Yoo teaches a few yards from here or a few hundred yards from here at the Bolt Hall Law School has not been out of my mind, because I regard him as a very significant player in the imposition of torture by the United States government, which I said earlier was one of the most shocking things of my life. I think he's perfectly sincere. I don't doubt his sincerity. I've never met him. Everybody says he's a very engaging man, personally. My answer to that is somebody who's being waterboarded or beaten up or kept in freezing cold room for days wouldn't be charmed by his ingratiating qualities.
Jeffrey Toobin talks about what a nice guy Clarence Thomas is to the people around the Supreme Court, but that doesn't change what he writes or what he does either.
No, but I wouldn't say that Clarence Thomas and John Yoo are in the same category. Clarence Thomas has a different view of the Constitution from mine, but it's a perfectly, you know, straightforward view, and it isn't torture, and it isn't this or that. It's a view, and he's entitled to it, and he is very friendly. There's no doubt of it. But I think to say, as Professor Yoo did, that a president can order prisoners tortured and cannot be overruled by Congress, that he has that inherent power to order prisoners tortured, is really pretty bad.
What would you say to Dianne Feinstein when she votes for an amendment in favor of outlawing burning of the flag?
I would tell her to go back and read Jefferson and Madison and try to think what this country is about. Actually, she's not the only one who did that, you know. Hillary Clinton put forward some kind of, I don't know exactly what it was, a sort of compromise statute to protect the flag from burning not so long ago, and I thought that was rather foolish. You know, the end of Justice Brennan's opinion in the flag burning case is the last sentence of the opinion speaks of allowing the burning of this emblem we revere makes it worth revering. The fact that we can do it is something very basic in us. It's not nice, but it's important.
Anthony Lewis, 3 or 4 years ago, maybe a little more, let's say 2003, a lot of people were very scared that we were on the verge of a fascist regime. I remember talking to Robert McNeil, who said, I'm concerned, however, I think the ship will right itself. Do you think the ship has righted itself? And back then, were you that concerned?
I was pretty concerned, particularly by the two issues I've mentioned. The fact that two American citizens, and that was only a prelude, were being held without trial, without counsel, in solitary confinement, and according to the United States government, the Bush administration's lawyers, they could be held that way without counsel, I repeat, not able to speak to anybody for the rest of their lives, and the fact that prisoners were being tortured, I thought was really dangerous and worrying for our future. I think the public reaction and the Supreme Court's reaction to those two things, although it's only been a very tentative reaction so far, led the Bush administration to trim its sails a bit and not make these extreme claims. We can do it forever. We can pick out anybody on the street and just put them in jail when we feel like it. They wouldn't say that. They might like to do it, but they don't say it anymore. But I think the fact that, as we discussed earlier, the American public has not really expressed profound outrage at these practices remains very worrying.
Are we in danger of a coup, or is that day past?
I don't think we're in danger of a coup, no. I think the fact that the last midterm election turned out as it did, not that it's had a profound effect on politics in Washington, it hasn't, but at least it showed that there was a degree of caring in the public and a degree of response to things that had gone wrong, particularly Iraq.
And speaking of Iraq, how do you look upon all those the people who try to find legalisms for why it was a legal invasion?
My answer is that the imagination of lawyers knows no bounds.
Anthony Lewis, before we went on the air, I asked you about William Crystal becoming a columnist for the New York Times, and you mumbled something which you could repeat now if you want, but why do you think they did it, and what is your view of that?
Well, I'm not privy to why they did it. I've retired from the New York Times, as you said. I've been working there, I hate to tell you, for 50 years. I have no particular insight into the process. I mean, we can imagine that they thought they needed another conservative writer to have a broader appeal. They've been attacked a lot by the conservative, or we could better say right-wing talk show hosts. Maybe this is a defensive step. I don't know. I will say that William Crystal is a very intelligent person. He's very clever. I thought he made a mistake in his first couple of columns. Maybe this is just a columnist criticism. By writing columns that were really like boilerplate conservative Republican screeds, as if they were put out by the Republican National Committee. You have to be a little surprising as a columnist. David Brooks, who came aboard the Times some years ago as a columnist, advertises the conservatives, does that a lot. He surprises you, and that's important. You have to surprise people.
When I talked to Frank Rich, he said the other problem is finding the material. He dropped down to once a week because he felt that twice a week was just too much for him, just coming up with stuff.
My last year or two on the paper, one, I think, I dropped down to one column a week, maybe a tribute to my advancing age, although I've written a book now. I guess I can still write. But I always thought that if I didn't have two ideas a week, I ought to quit. Of course, you have to have the ideas, and they should be original or fresh or maybe sounding an old theme. I sounded old themes a lot, but with a fresh story. That's the game. If you can't do it, you should get out of it.
What do you think of the current coverage of this election in particular? Do you think it's better or worse than previous, about the same?
It's hard to say because it's such an interesting election. Does that arise from the coverage or from the characters? Who would have thought a few years ago that the Democratic Party would be choosing between a black and a woman? It's rather wonderful, isn't it? In a way, if you take the long view of history, it's quite thrilling because that was unthinkable even a few years ago. I mean, it would have been to me. I wouldn't have thought it would happen. Or that the Republican race would come down to two people with very distinct personalities. So maybe it's the inherent interest of the candidates that makes it seem quite interesting to me. I don't know that the coverage is any different. Yes, I think it is. I think it's more intense and certainly more of it. I'm reading a lot about it, and I'm enjoying it. I think we're doing a pretty good job, the journalists.
Some people could complain that the reason that John Edwards got short shrift and had to drop out is not so much because what he said or who he was didn't resonate, but because he just didn't get the coverage because he wasn't a black or a woman.
Gosh, I don't think that's true. That thought hadn't entered my mind before now. Edwards was a very winning candidate. I don't mean in the sense of winning votes, but pleasing. And, you know, if you look at it logically in the old-fashioned way, to have a white Southerner as your candidate might be a very good ticket. But I think maybe the public was just ready for something different. The Democratic public, I should say.
Right.
Don't know about the rest of the public.
I know that this is really going out on a limb, but do you think that whether it's a woman, I mean, obviously Hillary Clinton has her own baggage beyond being a woman, or a black, how do you think in a general election, do you think Republicans can really gain traction from that, or do you think...
Gain traction from what?
From the fact that it's a woman or a black person.
Oh.
Or do you think maybe America, despite George W. Bush and his immaturity, has matured?
I think it has matured. I don't know how people will vote when they actually get in to pull the lever for president of the United States. You know, that's the so-called Bradley effect, that Tom Bradley, the mayor of Los Angeles, showed it well ahead in the polls for governor. whatever year that was, and didn't win. And the Bradley effect, so-called by the pollsters, was that in the secrecy of the booth, people were not ready to vote for a black candidate. I don't think that's true anymore, but who can be sure? A black or a woman may have drawbacks, but Hillary Clinton has other drawbacks, as you just implied. There are a lot of people, irrationally in my judgment, who just think she's poison and she's a radical. Well, she isn't any more radical than this microphone. Oh, maybe I said the wrong thing. I don't know. Maybe it's a radical microphone. Anyway, she's been hated all along for reasons that elude me because she seems perfectly straightforward and sensible to me. I'm not saying I'm for her. I'm not. I'm not for anybody. But I just don't understand the hatred.
One final question. Jeffrey Toobin, in concluding his book on the Supreme Court, which you very much admire, talked about the most important element in this coming election is going to be who gets to choose a Supreme Court justice. As someone who's been writing about the legal issues now, like I said, since the 50s, what is your view on that? And given the fact that whether Republican or Democratic president is elected, we're probably going to have two Democratic houses of Congress. How important, then, is that in terms of determining who you're going to vote for?
I think Jeffrey Toobin is absolutely right. I've thought it for years. It's been a dominant factor in my votes for president for quite a long time because I care about the Supreme Court, and you only have to look at the effect of Bush's two recent appointments to know that it's pretty important. It just revolutionized large areas of the law. So I think it matters a lot, and so do the Republicans. John McCain, who's pretty cantankerous and not always a straight-liner, has made a great point of showing his conservative credentials by saying that he will appoint Supreme Court justices that will appeal to conservatives. It's very important for conservatives, so it should be important to liberals as well. They haven't cared enough. They ought to care a lot.
Anthony Lewis, now you've finished writing, publishing Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. You working on anything, still writing for The Nation?
I'm more likely to write these days, though I don't have a thing pending. I'm on a book tour, you know, it takes your time, for the New York Review of Books, which takes long pieces of the kind that I've come to like, and has a wonderful editor. Robert Silvers, very learned. He usually knows more about the book you're reviewing than you do.
You've been listening to an interview with Anthony Lewis, whose most recent book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.